and crossed the $1,000 a coin mark for the second time in its life. The People's Bank of China, PBOC, announced it was investigating Bitcoin trading on Chinese exchanges. Shortly after, the PBOC issued new regulations for the trading of Bitcoin on exchanges within the country, including curtailing margin trading, requiring trading fees, and demanding stronger anti-money laundering and know-your-customer protocols. All of these requirements were understandable and have helped to legitimize Bitcoin, but they did lead to a noticeable decline in Chinese trading volume, which for much of 2016 was still greater than 90% of trading volumes worldwide in Bitcoin. China was responsible for over 90% of all Bitcoin trading volume worldwide. And now the PBOC was placing restrictions on this activity. The situation was eerily similar to a late 2013 incident when the PBOC rolled out new regulations after Bitcoin crossed the $1,000 mark for the first time. Bitcoin's price crashed then and continued to decline for over a year, and many feared the same would happen after the PBOC's commentary in 2017. While the price did initially fall precipitously, within a month it had recovered and would shortly move to all-time highs. This was a very different reaction than 2013. Bitcoin's price resilience in 2017 compared to the devastating price impact in 2013 reveals a valuable lesson for the innovative investor on the importance of trading volumes, exchange diversity, and trading pair diversity. In December 2013, trading volumes averaged $60 million, whereas in December 2016, they averaged $4.1 billion. Hence, there was significantly more market depth leading into the PBOC announcement in 2017 than there was in 2013. Furthermore, in 2013, Bitcoin trading occurred on a much more limited number of exchanges. Most activity was at Mt. Gox. Currency pair diversity was not nearly as robust either, both through different fiat currencies or other crypto assets. In 2017, Bitcoin was able to recover quickly because market liquidity, exchange diversity, and trading pair optionality came through in spades. As a result, when the PBOC issued its regulations, there were plenty of other investors and traders outside of China to pick up the slack, leading to an inversion in market share of fiat currencies used to trade Bitcoin. The Chinese yuan's percent of market share fell from 90-plus percent to less than 10%. The increase of dollar and yen trading in Bitcoin is dramatic after January 22, 2017. Traders of Bitcoin weren't rattled by the Chinese regulations for long, and increased investments from the United States and Japan filled the void and buoyed Bitcoin's price. Trading pair diversity as a sign of maturity for crypto assets. Balancing the diversity of exchanges and trading pairs is important for the robustness of any asset, including crypto assets. Learning from Bitcoin's reliance on too few currencies and exchanges early in its young life, we can now follow the trading pair diversity of other crypto assets, especially with regard to fiat currency pairs. Fiat currency pairs are particularly important for crypto assets because they require significant integration with pre-existing financial infrastructures. Due to high levels of required compliance, only a small number of crypto asset exchanges offer the capability to accept fiat currency or connect to investors' bank accounts. These exchanges, such as Bitstamp, GDAX, ItBit, Gemini, Kraken, and a few others, are hesitant to provide access to all crypto assets, as they do not want to encourage trading in those that are not reputable. Given their caution, it is a stamp of approval for a crypto asset to be added to their platforms. Ethereum's Ether provides a study on how exchanges adding a crypto asset can increase the diversity of the trading pairs used to buy the asset. If our hypothesis on the importance of fiat currencies in crypto asset trading holds, then as an asset grows in maturity and legitimacy, it should have more diversity in its trading pairs, with particularly strong growth in fiat currencies being used to buy the asset. That has certainly been the case with Ether. Over the course of 2016, the diversity in trading pairs used to buy it has grown significantly. The dollar has shown particular strength, and overall fiat currencies have increased from less than 10% of Ether's trading volume in the spring of 2016 to nearly 50% in the spring of 2017. We encourage the innovative investor to monitor the increase of trading pair diversity as a way to check the growing robustness and maturity of a single crypto asset within the broader asset class. CryptoCompare.com is a good tool to identify these trends. Decreasing volatility as a crypto asset matures. Greater trading volumes, liquidity, exchange diversity, and trading pair diversity all lead to more resilience in the market. The crypto asset is better able to absorb shocks without wild price swings, or at least with price swings that are diminishing in severity over time, which translates into a decrease in volatility. We should expect to see decreasing volatility in crypto assets when we plot this volatility over time. Since we already covered Bitcoin's decreasing volatility in Chapter 7, we will showcase the other crypto assets here. From these trends, we can infer that this declining volatility is a result of increased market maturity. Certainly, the trend is not a straight line, and there are significant bumps in the road, depending on particular events. For example, Monero had a spike in volatility in late 2016 because it experienced a significant price rise. This shows that volatility is not only associated with a tanking price, but also a skyrocketing price. The general trend, nonetheless, is of dampening volatility. Bitcoin has the lowest volatility because its markets are the most liquid and it has the greatest diversity of support from different exchanges and asset trading pairs. While Bitcoin has sustained its low volatility, Ether has come down significantly and Dash has varied widely. We included Dash because we posit that it will continue to have problems with volatility over time. While it is gaining in acceptance, which should decrease its volatility, its software architecture creates a liquidity problem by requiring master nodes, entities similar to miners but unique to Dash's architecture, to lock up a large amount of the Dash outstanding. Such a requirement impedes the liquidity of Dash's markets, thereby making the markets more prone to volatility. Interestingly, just because an asset has a rapid price increase doesn't mean it must do so in a volatile manner. For example, through 2016, Bitcoin more than doubled in price but decreased in volatility. Its daily gains and occasional losses were close enough to the mean not to register as overly volatile. Such behavior can indicate big traders are taking positions in an asset. Often they gauge how much they are moving the price of an asset and make sure not to do so above a certain percentage point. In this way, they minimize volatility and slowly ease into a big position over a series of days, weeks, or months. As these assets mature and their volatility decreases, recall that this can help boost the Sharpe ratio. Recall that since the Sharpe ratio is absolute returns divided by volatility, if volatility comes down, then the returns don't have to be as stupendously good for the Sharpe ratio to still be a standout. Marketplace behavior, correlations. As an asset class is first emerging, it will be uncorrelated with the broader capital markets because there is not much overlap between the early adopters of that asset and the broader capital market investors. This is exactly what we saw with Bitcoin when it was first invented and was only known to a small core group of developers and adopters. At that time, with minimal overlap between Bitcoin and capital market investors, Bitcoin's correlation with other common asset classes was close to zero. Events that made the broader capital markets move had no effect on Bitcoin, and vice versa. As Bitcoin's use grew, so too did its fame. It is now routinely discussed in publications such as the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, and Forbes on a near-weekly basis. As a result, not only has it become part of the conversation, it's also becoming an investment vehicle for a larger audience within the broader capital markets. Bitcoin's increased acceptance among capital market investors explains why it has surged on news that could be detrimental to other markets, such as Brexit, the surprise Trump election win, and the devaluation of the Chinese yuan. Despite the many PBOC interventions, Chinese citizens used Bitcoin to protect themselves against the erosion in value of their national currency. As the yuan decreases in value, the price of Bitcoin increases. Such a correlation implies that people are likely buying Bitcoin to protect themselves from further devaluation of the yuan. While we expect to see Bitcoin become increasingly correlated, either positively or negatively, with other broadly used asset classes as new crypto assets are born, they will likely have a low to zero correlation with the broader capital markets. At best, what they will show is some form of correlation with Bitcoin, as it is of the same asset class. It should be expected that examples within an asset class will move together in some fashion. For example, leading up to the decision on the Winklevoss Bitcoin ETF on March 10, 2017, Bitcoin became increasingly correlated with Ether and Monero, and increasingly negatively correlated with Litecoin. Since Litecoin is such a close derivative of Bitcoin, investors likely became concerned that people would rotate out of Litecoin and move into Bitcoin if the Bitcoin ETF was approved. Ether and Monero, on the other hand, are significantly different crypto assets, and therefore are held as complementary to Bitcoin in a crypto portfolio. As Bitcoin rose and fell, so too did these assets. This reinforces the need for the innovative investor to become knowledgeable about these assets' specific characteristics and recognize where correlations may or may not occur. We expect to see more of this correlation trend play out. At best, newer crypto assets will show some behavior tied to Bitcoin and its siblings, either positively or negatively. Then, as the crypto asset grows, so too will its capital pool, and soon enough, this will overlap with more traditional assets, strengthening its price relationship with the broader capital markets. Although we're seeing maturation of these assets and greater overlaps with others, it's fair to consider Bitcoin and crypto assets to be in their early stages. There is still a lack of understanding by most investors. Innovative investors may be more educated on this topic than most, but they will encounter those who see crypto assets as speculative pump-and-dump vehicles, or worse. The next two chapters will address these arguments by putting crypto assets in the context of the history of past investment bubbles, scams, and speculation. Chapter 10. The Speculation of Crowds and This Time is Different Thinking. On its path to maturity, Bitcoin's price has experienced euphoric rises and harrowing drops, as have many crypto assets. One of the most common complaints among Bitcoin and crypto asset naysayers is that these fluctuations are driven by the Wild West nature of the markets, implying that crypto assets are a strange new breed that can't be trusted. While each crypto asset and its associated markets are at varying levels of maturity, associating Wild West behavior as unique to crypto asset markets is misleading at best. Equities, which many consider to be transacted on the most transparent, efficient, and fair markets in the world, had a rocky first couple of centuries. Yes, centuries. Not only were these markets prone to mass speculation, as people raced to buy and sell based on mostly fabricated rags-to-riches stories, but many times the markets were rigged against participants. Misleading prospectuses, manipulation of share prices, false accounting, and issuance of forged paper shares all led to losses. The reality is that some of the most trusted markets in the world today also had Wild West beginnings. By examining the most famous examples of markets gone wrong, specifically the sequence of events, the innovative investor is better informed by history to protect present and future wealth. When patterns reappear, it's a good time to exit right, or at least reassess one's investment strategy. This thinking is prudent with regard to any investment, including a venture into crypto assets. These examples also show that crypto assets are not going through bizarre growing pains unique to them. Instead, they are experiencing the same evolutionary process that new asset classes over hundreds of years have had to go through as they matured. For those interested in a thorough history of such events, we highly recommend Edward Chancellor's Devil Take the Hindmost, A History of Financial Speculation. While the way in which markets become dangerous to investors changes over time and often becomes less insidious the more the asset and its associated markets mature, the potential for markets to destabilize never disappears. Much of the world learned that lesson during the financial crisis of 2008. Broadly, we categorize five main patterns that lead to markets destabilizing. The speculation of crowds. This time is different. Ponzi schemes. Misleading information from asset issuers. Cornering. The first two will be detailed in this chapter, while the latter three we reserve for the next chapter. In addition to historical examples from decades past, we also give examples of how these patterns have manifested in crypto asset markets. The speculation of crowds. While often given a bad name, speculation in and of itself is not a bad thing. For millennia, speculation has been integral to markets and trading, with some of the earliest evidence coming from 2nd century BC Rome. The root of the word speculate comes from the Latin specular, which means to spy out, watch, observe, examine, explore. Speculators are keenly focused on the movement of the market, observing its swings and taking action accordingly. Speculators generally differ from investors in the duration they intend to hold assets. They do not buy an asset with the intent to hold it for years. Rather, they buy the asset for an abbreviated period before selling it likely to the next speculator. Sometimes they do this to capitalize on short-term information they believe will move the market. Other times they do it because they expect to ride the momentum of the market, regardless of its fundamentals. In short, they try to profit within the roller coaster ride. In comparison, the innovative investor diligently investigates the fundamentals of value for investing and exits the investment when the markets no longer appear rational. In our view, no matter the investment, it's important to discern when one is investing and when one is speculating. Benjamin Graham and David Dodd attempted to define the difference between investing and speculation in their book Security Analysis. An investment operation is one which, upon thorough analysis, promises safety of principal and a satisfactory return. Operations not meeting these requirements are speculative. In his book, The Intelligent Investor, Graham recognized that speculation would always be present in the investing world, but he saw a need to distinguish between good and bad speculation. He wrote, "There is intelligent speculation, as there is intelligent investing. But there are many ways in which speculation may be unintelligent." While speculators have often been scorned, they were perhaps most famously denigrated by Franklin D. Roosevelt in his inaugural address on March 4, 1933. As America was struggling through the Great Depression, which many pinned on the stock market crash of 1929, there was strong resentment against speculators. Every crisis loves a scapegoat. In his speech, Roosevelt called them money changers to invoke religious judgment. Primarily, this is because rulers of the exchange of mankind's goods have failed through their own stubbornness and their own incompetence, have admitted their failure, and have abdicated. Practices of the unscrupulous money changers stand indicted in the court of public opinion, rejected by the hearts and minds of men. True, they have tried, but their efforts have been cast in the pattern of an outworn tradition. Faced by failure of credit, they have proposed only the lending of more money. Stripped of the lure of profit by which to induce our people to follow their false leadership, they have resorted to exhortations, pleading tearfully for restored confidence. They know only the rules of a generation of self-seekers. They have no vision, and when there is no vision, the people perish. The money changers have fled from their high seats in the temple of our civilization. We may now restore that temple to the ancient truths. The measure of the restoration lies in the extent to which we apply social values more noble than mere monetary profit. While Roosevelt's judgment is understandable, market realities show that speculation has its place in the investment world. Speculators often jump on opportunities more quickly than does a typical investor, which begins the process of pricing new information into the value of an asset. In seeking to profit from opportunity, speculators help drive the search between buyers and sellers for a mutually agreed-upon price. When a shortage of an asset is on the horizon, whether it be energy commodities or electronic hardware, speculators will quickly bid up the price of that good. As a result, more suppliers are drawn to the market, accelerating the alleviation of the shortage in classic supply and demand economics. When it comes to innovation such as the introduction of railroads, automobiles, or the Internet, speculations serve to allocate money to the rapid build-out of the infrastructures necessary to support these sweeping innovations. Speculators are the ones who first allocate money because they have the highest tolerance for risk and are always on the lookout for new information. While speculation typically ends with a supply glut because too much money eventually pours into the innovation, the glut is often temporary. The arrival and implementation of copious amounts of capital may lead to an excess of capacity, but as the innovation gains mass adoption over the following decades, the abundance of infrastructure proves useful. Such was the case with the rapid build-out of railways in Europe in the mid-1800s, and the deployment of fiber optic cables to support the Internet in the 1990s. Single speculators, or small groups of them, typically do not destabilize markets. It is when the groups turn into crowds that the negative ramifications build. In this sense, the vitriol should not be directed so much at speculation, but instead at crowd behavior that overtakes the capital markets. Crowd theory was pioneered by Gustave Le Bon, whose most famous work was The Crowd, A Study of the Popular Mind. In his later book, The Psychology of Revolution, Le Bon wrote, "Man as part of a multitude is a very different being from the same man as an isolated individual. His conscious individuality vanishes in the unconscious personality of the crowd." Among the other characteristics of crowds, we must note their infinite credulity and exaggerated sensibility, their short-sightedness, and their incapacity to respond to the influences of reason. Affirmation, contagion, repetition, and prestige constitute almost the only means of persuading them. Reality and experience have no effect upon them. These characteristics are dangerous in the context of a market. Credulity, or to be more direct, gullibility, leads the masses to readily believe what they are told, whether by fellow speculators or the management behind different assets coming to market. Credulity is often what draws individual speculators to the crowd, and once there, the speculator is trapped within groupthink. The four characteristics of persuasion Le Bon mentions only exacerbate the situation. Affirmation leads the credulous to more strongly believe in their strategies when the market continues to go up, and that thinking spreads like a contagion. This pattern is repeated again and again as the speculators chase the returns of the most prestigious of assets. Unfortunately, when the market turns and the prestige is gone, the contagion of terror spreads just as quickly through the speculative crowd. Tulip Mania. The most famous instance of mass speculation in a commodity happened in the Dutch Republic in the 1630s. As with most periods of mass speculation, the time was right. With their merchants fueling trade, the Dutch enjoyed the highest salaries of any in Europe. Financial innovation was in the air, and money was free-flowing. Shares of the Dutch East India Company had been rewarding shareholders handsomely for their investments. Fueled by enthusiasm, wealthy citizens poured money into properties, leading to a robust housing market. The ongoing appreciation of asset values created an excess of wealth to fund further asset purchases, setting up a positively reinforcing feedback loop into asset bubble territory. While the wealthy sowed the grounds for an asset bubble, initially not everyone could take part. Dutch East India shares were expensive and illiquid, making them inaccessible to all but the rich. And the same went for prized properties. A tulip, on the other hand, was much more affordable. Yet due to a quirk of nature, an affordable tulip had the potential to morph into one that would make its owner rich. A virus transmitted by aphids turned solid-colored tulips into a prized variegated variety, with streaks of lighter hues through darker colors, resembling flames. The cause of such variegation was not known at the time, and so lent itself to speculation, as people tried to predict which tulips would develop the unique coloration. On the other side of the transformation, however, was death, as the virus eventually killed the tulip. Speculators, therefore, passed the tulips around like hot potatoes, hoping they could sell them to the next speculator for a higher price, until the last person was left with a claim on a dead tulip. Tulips had promised value since their introduction to Europe in the mid-1500s, but it was not until 1634 and the spread of the virus that prices increased exponentially, causing what is commonly referred to as tulip mania. What began with small groups of speculators turned into crowds of speculators, as outsiders from other countries were drawn to Dutch tulip markets upon hearing stories of the immense riches to be gained. Meanwhile, the experienced withdrew from participation or shunned the tulip trade, as explained by Chancellor. The wealthy amateur bulb collectors, who had long shown a readiness to pay vast sums for the rarer varieties, withdrew their custom as prices began to soar, while the great Amsterdam merchants continued investing their trading profits in townhouses, East India stock, or bills of exchange. For them, tulips remained merely an expression of wealth, not a means to that end. Since much of a tulip's life is spent as a bulb and not a blossom, it lends itself to a futures market, which the Dutch called a wind handle, or the wind trade. A futures market is where a buyer and a seller agree to the future price of a good. When that specific time arrives, the buyer must pay the seller the agreed-upon amount. However, in those days, waiting for that agreed-upon time was not fast enough for the crowds of speculators. The tulip futures contracts themselves were traded, sometimes as many as 10 times in a day. Considering these trades were made person to person, 10 trades in a day was representative of a liquid and frenzied market. With the futures market, the value of tulips could be abstracted even more. People didn't have to worry about the actual delivery of the tulip. They just had to make sure they could sell the contract for a higher price than they themselves had bought it for. While the frenzy over tulips had been building for a few years, the mania peaked during the winter of late 1636 and early 1637, when the tulip bulbs were still dormant in the ground. Therefore, the period of greatest speculation during tulip mania was not accompanied by a single blossoming tulip changing hands. Two factors made the crowd speculation even worse. According to a study in The Economist, government officials were in on the action themselves and moved to change the futures contracts to options. The result was that investors who had bought the right to buy tulips in the future were no longer obligated to buy them. If the market price was not high enough for investors' liking, they could pay a small fine and cancel the contract. The balance between risk and reward in the tulip market was skewed massively in investors' favor. The inevitable result was a huge increase in tulip options prices. The second factor was that much of the trade began to be financed by notes of personal credit. Therefore, not only were the bulbs not changing hands, neither was physical money. Transactions were made on simple promises to deliver money in the future. It should be clear to the innovative investor that the delusion of value here was created by the frenzy of a crowd. As Chancellor points out, by the later stages of the mania, the fusion of the wind handle with paper credit created the perfect symmetry of insubstantiality. Most transactions were for tulip bulbs that could never be delivered because they didn't exist, and were paid for with credit notes that could never be honored because the money wasn't there. Cheap credit often fuels asset bubbles, as seen with the housing bubble that led to the financial crisis of 2008. Similarly, crypto asset bubbles can be created using extreme margin on some exchanges, where investors are effectively gambling with money they don't have. Back to tulips. At that time, the guilder served as currency in the Dutch Republic. Paper money didn't exist. Instead, metal that held real value was used. Each guilder contained 0.027 ounces of gold. Therefore, 37 guilders held an ounce of gold, and 592 guilders contained a pound of gold. The highest recorded amount paid for a tulip was 5,200 guilders, or the equivalent of nearly 9 pounds of gold. At that time, an average year's work yielded 200 to 400 guilders, and modest townhouses could be bought for 300 guilders. The tulip that fetched 9 pounds of gold was worth the equivalent of 18 modest townhouses. Speculators were paying for single tulips with what would take them over a decade to pay off, and with money they didn't have. It all came crashing down in February 1637. Spring was approaching, and tulips would be blossoming soon. Contractual dates would soon require the conversion of the notes of credit into real money. The merchants that drove the economic machine were largely unaffected because they had continued investing their trading profits in townhouses, East India stock, or bills of exchange. While it was the wealth of these merchants that caused the masses to yearn for similar riches, the merchants were unscathed by the crash they precipitated. The crash did not set off a recession throughout the economy, which was one saving grace of tulip mania. It was the common people, less experienced in investing, that had been swept up in the madness of the crowd who were the hardest hit. Fights over the amount due per contract ensued. A little over a year after the bubble burst, the Dutch government stepped in to declare that the contracts could be settled for 3.5% of their initial value. While a marked improvement over paying the full contract, 3.5% of the most expensive tulip would still require a year's work for some unlucky citizens. The speculation of crowds comes to crypto assets. As with tulip mania, crypto assets are vulnerable to the speculation of crowds. This is especially true as people fixate on the incredible return some early Bitcoin investors enjoyed and hope that the latest cryptocurrency, crypto commodity, or crypto token will make them rich too. However, remember that just because the unfettered enthusiasm of a crowd takes an asset to unreasonable highs doesn't mean the asset itself is flawed. Tulips are still enjoyed and sold worldwide. And, as we saw with the tech and telecom boom, there were gems such as Amazon and Salesforce that would reward their patient investors spectacularly for years to come. The investors who got burned were the ones who bought because everyone else was buying, and then sold because everyone else was selling. The best way to avoid getting burned in this manner is to do proper due diligence and have an investment plan that is adhered to. If the urge is to buy the asset because everyone else is buying it and it keeps going up, then it's likely best to walk away from any consideration of that investment. Speculative bubbles are particularly dangerous when there is no underlying long-term value proposition to the asset. In these cases, it's as bad as gambling, or worse, as there's an illusion of value. We sometimes hear skeptical investors warn of the dangers of Bitcoin. Nout Welling, the former president of the Dutch Central Bank, is famous for saying, "This is worse than the tulip mania. At least then you got a tulip. Now you get nothing." While we understand that some may have a hard time grasping that something with no physical form could have value, at this point in its life, Bitcoin is a far cry from tulips. The key to understanding Bitcoin's value is recognizing it has utility as Money Over Internet Protocol, MOIP, allowing it to move large amounts of value to anyone anywhere in the world in a matter of minutes, which drives demand for it beyond mere speculation. While tulips have aesthetic appeal, it is a stretch to argue that their utility is on par with MOIP in the digital age. It's important to investigate the underlying utility of any other crypto asset that the innovative investor may be considering. That said, Bitcoin has had periods when crowds momentarily overtook the markets. These times are worthwhile to examine and learn from, and it's important to note that Bitcoin has always recovered from these periods of mass speculation, a major differentiator from tulips. There are six periods over the last 8 years when the crowd temporarily controlled the Bitcoin market. The innovative investor will take note that the power of crowds to move Bitcoin's markets has been moderating over time. We include this dive into Bitcoin's speculative past to help inform future investigation of crypto assets as they come to market and inevitably get swept up in periods of mass speculation. Bitcoin bubbles. When Mt. Gox was established, Bitcoin finally became accessible to the mainstream. Prior to this point, Bitcoin holders had mostly been computer and cryptography whizzes, acquiring Bitcoin as a function of running the computers that supported the network. What is immediately apparent is Bitcoin's price appreciation in the year following the opening of Mt. Gox. When Mt. Gox opened, Bitcoin was worth less than 10 cents, and just a year later, it was worth over $10. While $10 may not sound like much, consider that in the period of a year, Bitcoin increased 100-fold, meaning that a $100 investment had turned into $10,000. Another significant leg up was in November 2013, when Bitcoin made its infamous run past the price of $1,000 per coin for the first time. While many people new to the space think that was Bitcoin's first bubble, in fact, it had many bubbles before that. Bitcoin has experienced 6 one-month periods when it doubled in price. 3 of these doublings happened in the year after the opening of Mt. Gox. The last ascent during this period was the most phenomenal, when on May 13, 2011, the price increased more than 700% over the previous month. While there were respective drivers to these price runs, by and large, they were fueled by the ability of more mainstream users to gain access to Bitcoin through Mt. Gox. Small pieces of information created snowball effects that took the market by storm. To understand how these bubbles unfolded, it is helpful to quantify certain aspects. First, we will define a Bitcoin bubble cycle as being recognizable on the first day that Bitcoin's price has doubled from its price 30 days prior. The bubble ends when the price stops falling from the month prior, firming up with month-over-month gains for 3 straight days. Price bubbles after the launch of Mt. Gox peaked at the following prices on the following dates. November 6, 2010, 39 cents. February 9, 2011, $1.09. June 8, 2011, $29.60. January 8, 2012, $7.11. April 9, 2013, $230. December 4, 2013. $1,147. Clearly, the time periods soon after the launch of Mt. Gox were particularly exciting, but also at times harrowing. On the other side of every peak, there is a dangerous trough, and Bitcoin investors in these bubbles were not spared. Within the period defined as a Bitcoin bubble, the average decline from peak price to trough price was 63%. The bubbles that peaked in June 2011 and December 2013 were particularly devastating, with losses of 93% and 85% respectively. More insidious than the precipitous nature of the losses is how they unfolded compared to the rises. Sharp rises are often characterized by investor exuberance, quickly escalating as more and more jubilantly pile in. The falls, on the other hand, are sustained excruciation. The ascent to the peak of a bubble is like a rocket taking off, while the descent is more like a parachute drifting to the ground. The longer duration of descents as opposed to ascents is important for the innovative investor to keep in mind, as sometimes it may feel like the drop from the peak of a bubble will never end. Immature investors will typically cry out in defeat when they can't tolerate further losses. Sadly, these last cries of capitulation are often when a bear market is getting ready to turn around. The Steemit Bubble. A large number of crypto assets other than Bitcoin have gone through similar stratospheric ascents, fueled by the speculation of crowds and corresponding descents. A good example was in the middle of 2016 when the new blockchain architecture Steemit caught everyone's attention. Its premise was to provide an open publishing or blogging platform on which authors who wrote good articles and posts were rewarded by readers with the crypto asset Steem. Steemit served as a decentralized Reddit of sorts, with flavors of the blogging site Medium mixed in. The architecture was supported by a convoluted, albeit innovative, flow of monetary policy between miners, content creators, content curators, and more. On July 1, 2016, the total network value of Steemit was around $16 million. 2 weeks later, it was around $350 million, a more than 20-fold increase. Such rapid changes in price are almost always fueled by mass speculation and not fundamental growth. Behavior changes slowly, and many of the use cases put forth by crypto assets will require the mainstream to adapt to these new platforms. Speculators, on the other hand, move quickly. Steem's price in Bitcoin terms would fall from its mid-July peak by 94% 3 months later, and by 97% at the end of the year. This doesn't mean the platform is bad. Rather, it shows how the speculation and excitement about its prospects fueled a sharp rise and fall in price. The Zcash Bubble. One of the most meteoric rises and crashes was the October 2016 rollout of the new privacy-focused cryptocurrency Zcash, ZEC. Few cryptocurrencies have been more anticipated than this one, and rightfully so, given its strong engineering team. Ethereum's Vitalik Buterin was an advisor and described Zcash as providing the advantages of using a public blockchain while still being sure that their private information is protected. Two well-regarded crypto asset investment firms, Pantera Capital and Digital Currency Group, were involved with Zcash as well. Zcash technology targeted the privacy-centric vertical that Dash and Monero occupied, both of which were in the top 10 of cryptocurrencies in terms of network value when Zcash was released. The excitement was palpable. Integral to the ensuing price bubble was how the Zcash team structured the issuance of Zcash, which they did with good intention. As we discussed in Chapter 5, they chose to follow an issuance model similar to Bitcoin's, which meant that upon launch of its blockchain, there would be 0 units of Zcash outstanding. From 0 units outstanding, all units would be issued organically through miners competing to add blocks to Zcash's blockchain and getting paid with newly minted Zcash via Coinbase transactions. The Zcash team had implemented a further tweak known as a slow start that would limit the initial size of Coinbase transactions to miners. The slow start was intended as a safety feature in case there were any bugs in Zcash's code. This prudent model was markedly different from the crowd sale model that many crypto assets have been pursuing, which will be discussed further in Chapter 16. But it also drastically limited the initial supply. Zcash frenzy was stoked further by the recent increase in popularity of futures trading of crypto assets. One exchange known as BitMEX began offering futures prior to the launch of Zcash, which spiked to 10 Bitcoin per Zcash. The combination of limited initial supply with widespread demand led to a classic supply shortage that boosted the price of Zcash. On the first day of trading, the coin momentarily achieved a price of 3,300 Bitcoin, or more than $2 million per Zcash on Poloniex. Within 2 days, it had crashed below 1 Bitcoin per Zcash and continued to fall, closing out 2016 at a price of 0.05 Bitcoin per Zcash, or roughly $48. While Zcash has since stabilized and continues to hold great promise as a crypto asset, its rocky start was caused by mass speculation. Words of warning for the innovative investor tempted by bubbles. Robert Shiller, author, professor, and Nobel Prize winner, defined a bubble as a social epidemic that involves extravagant expectations for the future. We've talked much about the expectations for the future of crypto assets. However, we also believe innovative investors must be grounded in common sense in order to identify proper investments from improper ones, and they need to recognize when buying opportunities exist and when the madness of the crowd has taken over. When a crypto asset is skyrocketing, it can be hard to resist the urge to jump in and ride the rocket. However, the timing can be precarious, and spotting the end of a bubble is not easy. By the time the bubble is popping and the speculation of crowds has turned on itself, it's often too late. Alan Greenspan encapsulated the idea nicely. You can spot a bubble. They're obvious in every respect. But it's impossible for the majority of participants in the market to call the date when it blows. Every bubble, by definition, deflates. This time is different. When asset markets are taken over by mass speculation and prices reach nosebleed territory, a common refrain can often be heard. This time is different. Typically, the logic goes that the markets have evolved from more primitive years and financial engineering innovations have led to robust markets that can't possibly crash. Time and again, this thesis has been refuted by subsequent market crashes. In their well-regarded book, This Time is Different, 8 Centuries of Financial Folly, Carmen Reinhart and Kenneth Rogoff deliver a 300-page tour de force to prove that this time is never different. They describe how this time is different thinking was used to justify the sustainability of jubilant markets prior to the 1929 crash that led to the Great Depression. Proponents of this time is different thinking claimed that business cycles had been cured by the creation of the Federal Reserve in 1913. The thinking was that the Federal Reserve could use monetary policy to boost economies when production and consumption were flagging, and they could reel in markets when they showed signs of overheating. Others pointed to increasing free trade, declining inflation, and scientific methods being applied to corporate management that were leading to much more accurate production and inventory levels. In the October 16, 1929 issue of the New York Times, Yale economist Irving Fisher declared, "Stock prices have reached what looks like a permanently high plateau." His proclamation would go down as the worst stock tip in history, as 8 days later, the market dropped by 11%. On October 28, it would fall another 13%. And on October 29th, another 12%. A month after this declaration was printed in the New York Times, Fisher went broke, and the Dow had lost almost half its value prior to the crash. Similar thinking characterized the tech and telecom boom in the late 1990s and early 2000s. As eloquently described by Chancellor, The 1990s bull market was accompanied by the reappearance of a new era ideology, similar to that of the 1920s. Known as the new paradigm or the Goldilocks economy, like the porridge in the fairy tale, it was neither too hot nor too cold. The theory suggested that the control of inflation by the Federal Reserve, the decline in the federal deficit, the opening of global markets, the restructuring of corporate America, and the widespread use of information technology to control inventory stock levels had combined to do away with the business cycle. Point for point, this was a reiteration of the New Era philosophy of Irving Fisher's day. Similar to the 1920s, in the 1990s, stock analysts and investment managers rationalized the expensive markets with the claim that the old methods of valuing companies no longer applied. There were new methods that justified the nosebleed prices. The same patterns persist. The idea of valuation, which we will tackle in the next chapters, is a particularly challenging one for crypto assets. Since they are a new asset class, they cannot be valued as companies are, and while valuing them based on supply and demand characteristics like that of commodities has some validity, it doesn't quite suffice. As a result, we predict that as the space grows, and likely to dizzying levels, we'll once again hear the refrain that old methods of valuation no longer apply. When the innovative investor hears that refrain, it will be important to stay on high alert and investigate if the new method of valuation really makes sense. Throughout this book, we've tried to stay on message that the innovative investor may be a new class of investor, just as crypto assets are a new asset class. However, we've also been reminding readers of lessons to be learned from the past and time-tested tools of portfolio and asset analysis. Ignoring these important lessons will lead people into the trap of thinking that not only are things different this time, but that they are different from other investors as well. Generally, these traps follow a pattern. Initially, there may be support for the underlying price appreciation, as with most fundamental innovations. But that price appreciation and the story behind it can become a self-fulfilling prophecy. People become entranced by stories of their friends and family making easy money, even when they knew little about what they bought. In times like these, as in tulip mania, many subscribe to the greater idiot ideal. People can make money so long as they are able to sell the asset at a higher price to an idiot greater than them. A key indicator of the unsustainability of mass speculation is when new and inexperienced entrants stream into the markets. Bubbles are typically worsened by cheap credit, as financial institutions provide speculators the means to take out loans so they can buy more of the asset than they could with cash on hand. In this sense, the financial institutions buy into the speculative bubble as they see the opportunity to make money, just as the institutions around them are making money off loans to frenzied speculators. Both individual speculators and financial institutions providing cheap credit fall into the rut of crowd theory and convince themselves that this time is different. To make matters worse, when markets are overheating is usually when misleading asset issuers, Ponzi operators, and market manipulators come out to play. For that reason, we'll turn to these three themes in the next chapter. Chapter 11. It's just a Ponzi scheme, isn't it? The example of tulip mania and similar events should remind the innovative investor that bubbles can appear quickly and violently, especially in crypto assets. These patterns have been repeated in Bitcoin's bubbles, Steam's stratospheric summer rise, and Zcash's post-release run. Given the emerging nature of the crypto asset markets, it's important to recognize that there is less regulation, some would say none, in this arena, and therefore bad behavior can persist for longer than it may in more mature markets. As activity grows in the Bitcoin and crypto asset markets, investors must look beyond the madness of the crowd and recognize that there are bad actors who seek easy prey in these young markets. The growth of new crypto assets and new investment products around them create a rapidly evolving marketplace in which financial criminals can exploit profit-seeking motives especially if the innovative investor doesn't perform proper due diligence. This chapter will focus on Ponzi schemes, misleading asset issuers, and the cornering of markets, also known as pump-and-dump schemes. As we've mentioned, those who lack an understanding of Bitcoin and crypto assets often express their disdain and ignorance with the proclamation, "It's just a Ponzi scheme." So let's start there. Ponzi schemes. Ponzi schemes, also referred to as pyramid schemes, are the most dangerous type of misleading asset. While it got its name from Charles Ponzi, an Italian who lived from 1882 to 1949, it existed before he was born. He just made it famous. The idea is simple. New investors pay old investors. As long as there are enough new investors, old investors will continue to be rewarded handsomely. For example, if an operator of a Ponzi scheme offered 20% returns into perpetuity, some investors would be duped into initially believing the operator. Call this Batch A of investors. The operator would encourage Batch A investors to tell their friends, who would become Batch B of even newer investors. The money Batch B investors invested would pay the 20% returns promised to the Batch A investors who brought them into the scheme. From there, Batch A and Batch B go and solicit Batch C, telling Batch C about this amazingly easy and rewarding investment product. The capital from Batch C goes to pay Batch A and Batch B, and so the Ponzi cycle continues indefinitely until there are not enough new investors to keep it going. The scheme falls apart when people realize no real value has been created, and everything is founded upon a scheme to dupe new investors into paying old investors. Tragically, investors often don't realize they are duping one another, and it is the operator of the Ponzi scheme who makes out handsomely. Before we turn to crypto assets, let's look at how Ponzi schemes have played out in traditional assets. Many think of bonds as a safe investment with steady cash flows. If they are issued by a government, then they also have the full backing of that government. As we will soon see, bonds have not always been safe, and in what has been labeled the first emerging market boom, many bonds turned out to be Ponzi schemes. For about a century after the equity bubbles brought on by the Mississippi Company and South Sea schemes, we'll cover the shady dealings of these companies in the next section, British investors stuck close to government-issued bonds. During the Napoleonic Wars from 1803 to 1815, the British government issued over £400 million of bonds, providing plenty of opportunity to bond investors. However, once peace reigned again, the British government had less need to borrow, and therefore the supply of government bonds shrank. At about the same time, South America was in the throes of rebellion against Spain, leading to the creation of new countries with a need for capital to build their infrastructure and join the developed world. An English newspaper claimed, "We may indulge the brightest hopes of these southern republics. They have entered upon a career of endless improvement, and will soon attain the knowledge and freedom and civilization of the happiest states of Europe." The opportunity to make money was the focus of hungry British investors, and it was fueled by stories of how British innovation would make these regions economic powerhouses, and that fabled gold and silver mines were up for grabs. Investors ended up dumping millions into these exotic and high-yielding loans, with little to no information on where the money ended up. For the most part, bonds were issued repeatedly to budding countries such as Chile, Colombia, and Peru, with the newer issues going to pay off the older issues in classic Ponzi finance. As put forth by Chancellor in his book, Devil Take the Hindmost, A History of Financial Speculation, the payment of interest from capital, otherwise known as Ponzi finance, created the illusion of viability, although no money was ever actually sent from South America to service the loans, to which it must be added that the borrowing countries received only a tiny fraction of the total sums for which they contracted. In other words, not only did very little of the money raised in Europe ever make it to South America for its intended purpose, But little to no money was ever sent from South America back to Europe to pay for the dividends the bonds promised. In one famous instance, there wasn't even the possibility of repayment, as the bonds were floated for an imaginary country called Poyais. These Poyasian bonds remain the only bond for a fake country to be issued on the London Stock Exchange. As with all Ponzi finance, the South American loan bubble had to burst, which it did in 1826. Every newly founded South American country